Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah, there's a delay.
Welcome to another show of At Home with Victoria. With your host, Victoria Gaither. And co-host, Michael Kay.
Good evening, everybody. 8 p.m. here on the East Coast, a very hot and sticky East Coast, I may add today. Temperatures range to 88 degrees with 175% 1,000-degree humidity rate. It was sticky as hell here. I couldn't believe it. But however, I can't complain. Before I start tonight's show, I want to actually make mention of the terrible loss in Oklahoma for more Oklahoma. People are just returning to their homes and really discovering nothing but a pile of rubble. Thankfully, the death toll, once reported at 51, is lowered to 24. However, 9 children actually are listed as fatalities as well. So I want to make a quick mention that if you want to go ahead and help out, please text Red Cross to 90999 to donate $10 to disaster relief. They appreciate it, and we all have the $10. So once again, thank you for joining another edition of At Home with Victoria. I am Michael Kay, your entertainment co-host for tonight. The lovely news lady is actually off tonight. She's repairing her own storm damage with some of her condo properties down in Ocean City, Maryland, so she's taking the night off. But I am super thrilled to announce that this is an At Home with Victoria exclusive. Brian Allen Lane, if you watch television, you know Brian Allen Lane. Brian Allen Lane is a novelist, nonfiction writer, media commentator, attorney, professor, and screenwriter. He has penned and produced hundreds of television pilots, including Remington Steele, Hunter in the House, Star Trek The Next Generation, and many others. He is a noted and award-winning author, and his new project, Thug the Book, I stayed up all night reading it last night till about 5:30 in the morning. Thug the Book is the story of academia gone sour, of public education hijacked for private gain. It's actually a living novel. It's right now a blog. If you want to go ahead and check it out, you can check it out at www.thugthebook.blogspot.com. And we're going to be talking to him about his past works. And then I will tell you, this is a fantastic read. Before we do so, Jackie D. Williams, past guest on the show, his new EP actually reached number 2 in the UK R&B Billboard charts. So we're going to start off with his newest. You can actually check his video out at jackiedwilliams.com or facebook.com/JackieDWilliams. This is Jackie D. Williams with Always On My Mind. When we get back, Brian Allen Lane is in the house. Don't go away.
Never thought I'd think this, but I think that I'm in love. Oh, this is crazy, you're the one I'm thinking of. We'll
always on my mind. A man who has been on my mind for the last 48 hours is Mr. Brian Allen Lane. Brian, thank you so much for joining us today at Allen with Victoria. Welcome. It's your first time, man. I'm taking your radio virginity.
It is. Thank you for putting me on your mind for the last 48 hours.
Absolutely. Brian, after reading Thug last night, I think it's important for me to go ahead and vet everybody who comes on the show, just to go ahead and make sure that everybody says who they say they are. It's a very revealing, I love the term you use, living novel, basically a work in progress. But Brian, you're a Cali guy, born and raised in Los Angeles, California, went to UCLA. How did you get into film and movies and stuff?
Oh, gosh. I was always a writer and always wanted to be a writer. And even though I wanted to do novels and short stories and prose writing, when you live in Los Angeles, you can't avoid ultimately winding up in film and TV if writing is what you want to do. So it sort of became that. It's a great way to learn on the job is writing for television, because you do a lot of writing and you make a lot of money in a hurry and learn how to be a better writer as you go. So.
Well, you make a lot of money if you're good. That'll go ahead and say, you know, you've had mild successes, you know, with Remington Steele and Star Trek: The Next Generation, and a dozen others, a dozen films, and everything like that. Do you prefer writing for the television or the big screen?
TV. TV is much more fun because it's a long-term novel if you look at it the right way, because you're thinking many episodes ahead and you're developing character arcs over longer periods of time. So from a writer's standpoint, there's a lot more to do, whereas a film is, you know, 2 hours, maybe a little bit longer, and you're cramming a lot of story into just in this day and age, a lot of action and not a lot of story.
Yeah. Would you find you write brilliantly as a novelist as well, and award winning. Even people who can't stand you like your work. I read your best selling book, Cat and Mouse, detested by the Boston Book Reviewer. people who don't like you like you.
Yeah, that's my proudest review, actually, because the reviewer there, just who I didn't know at all, but apparently he read it and just hated the fact that he loved it and couldn't put it down and hated what it told him about himself, I think. So he gave me a wonderful review.
What was Cat and Mouse really about?
Cat and Mouse was pitched as a me and the serial killer story. I was connected up with a serial killer in California named Bill Suff, whose family wanted to, you know, really make money off the rights to his story once he was convicted, and I was interested, as any nice Jewish boy from the Valley would be, in wow, I get to meet a serial killer. That's very cool. And so I found out he was a writer, and I thought, well, this is interesting. He got away with murder for years and years and years. Nobody knew he could have done it. Nobody suspected him. That's fascinating. Why is that? And then as I talked to him and dug into his life, I began to realize he didn't fit the pattern of serial killers, and that's why they couldn't profile him correctly. He hadn't been abused, hadn't gone through terrible stuff, and so because he didn't fit in, I thought, God, I've been through more tragedy than this guy has, and I'm not out killing people. And so that was the pitch. I literally went into a publisher and said, hey, I want to write a story about me hanging with a serial killer for the next year, and answer the question of why is he a serial killer and I'm not.
Yeah, I don't think there's many Jewish serial killers in my history. I mean, I don't seem to recall any right off the bat. But
you get Leopold and Loeb and a few guys like that.
Well, yeah, that's true. Speaking of sociopaths, I don't know if you're going ahead and following this Jodi Arias trial at all. Are you?
Absolutely, sure.
You are. You are one of those people. What's your little take? You think she's going to go ahead and get the death penalty?
Oh gosh. She should. B, she will. C, I hate the death penalty. So,
I'm mixed
about all those things.
Yeah, I've been very actually good at not being kind of obsessed with it, as I have been in past cases, and everything we have on coming up shortly is Linda Kinnebaden from HLN News, who knows everything Jodi Arias, so I'm looking very forward to catching up with the facts with her, because between Nancy Grace, I mean, I don't know what the hell to make of half the stuff, but... how many years did you spend in Hollywood writing for television and movies?
I started earning my living at it at the end of 1979, not to date myself. Prior to that, I had a couple of deals, but I wouldn't say I earned a living. I just made some money. But full time since 1979, and then got into teaching in 2001, 2002. So all the way up till that time, I was full time Hollywood.
Right. Your teaching is actually the base of Thug of the Book. You started to teach at California State University in Long Beach and in the Department of Film and Electronic Arts. And that's basically where Thug the Book starts. And for those actually paying attention and listening, go to thugthebook.com. .blogspot.com. I'm going to start with the first installment. I'm going to do this in orderly because, seriously, I am a slow reader at best, kind of a thing. And once I started reading, Brian, it took on a mind of its own. I love the fact that you include actual documentation backing up your so-called allegations, which by episode six, the truth becomes abundantly clear unless you're headless or, in a corpse. So let's go ahead and take a little break before we go ahead and do this. Let's go back to a little bit of music. This is Jackie D. Williams. Unite with me. I find it kind of ironic because you need to be united with your efforts taking this to the high level. You are seriously the third whistleblower, I hate to use that term, that I've met. And I do applaud everybody who decides to do the right thing and take the moral high ground. I think it's important. So don't go away. More with Brian Allen Lane right after this. This is Jackie D. Williams. Unite with me.
As if you have lost, you
tonight is Brian Allen Lane. So, Brian, you're in Hollywood. You're making money. You're on television. You're making good TV. You're making good films and everything. You decide to go ahead and take your bags of money and go to the CSULB and decide to make a difference. When you were hired, you actually gave back 10% of your wages. You wanted to go ahead and arm the students with fresh dreams and Hollywood connections and to actually have your connections help foster the next generation of great filmmaking. You met with Don Pera, and I think that's where the story begins. Take it away, buddy.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I went to UCLA and USC, and everything was very nice and wonderful there. But when I got to Cal State Long Beach, the reason I wanted to go there is the students there are incredible. It was certainly at that time a blue-collar school. Most of the kids there were the first in their families to go to college. An overwhelming majority of them worked by day to be able to held down full-time jobs in order to pay their tuition, even though tuition was not very expensive in those days. And I just felt in order to get into the film business, in order to create opportunity for yourself, number one, if you're a writer, you can do that because you can write a script and it has tremendous shelf life and it doesn't cost you anything to write a script. It just takes your time. But if you really want to make movies, that's an expensive proposition. Movies are a business. And the kids who don't have enough money to make good student films are at a disadvantage to the kids at SC, from SC, for example. So when I went to Long Beach, it was, hey, I want to put money of my own into a scholarship fund. I'm bringing all my Hollywood friends in to donate money. I want to create opportunities for these kids to interface with Hollywood, to do productions with professionals so that they have professional credits even while they're students. And so that was what I walked in the door to do. When I first met with Don Pera, who you talked about, that was the discussion when I was there auditioning and interviewing. I said, look, this place needs help. The kids need a better opportunities. He said, I couldn't agree with you more. What do you want to do? And that's where how it all started.
Yeah, I really enjoyed reading about when you addressed a new class. You basically called them megalomaniacs.
Listen, anybody who wants to succeed in the arts is out of their mind. My father, for all the decades that I was making money as a writer, he was still mortified that I hadn't stayed with law, because I had gone to law school and was working as a lawyer before the writing career took off. And he was thankfully delighted when I finally got the teaching job. He passed away that very year, but he thought, I could tell he said, you finally have a job where I don't have to worry at night. so what can I tell you? It's tough out there to get in entertainment. It's tough to be in the arts in any way, shape, or form. The people who do it are driven to do it and dedicated to do it. The film and TV is a collaborative medium, so it's not, like I said, it's not as easy as just being a writer or a painter. You've got to work with a lot of other people, and a lot of people have to bring their skills to the table, and a lot of people have to bring money to the table. So, yeah, you've got to be fairly megalomaniacal to think that you have an idea that's worth people spending millions of dollars to make and millions of dollars, in profit to go see. So, I do give a patented speech complimenting everybody in the class for being megalomaniacal.
And what? I really kind of thought maybe I'm a megalomaniac. I mean, I would love this for us to be a syndicated show, but then I would have to work too hard. So, quite frankly, I get a little lazy after a while. But you and Don Pera got to be really good friends. You shared stories together. You went on hunting trips. You shared health concerns, kind of a thing.
Well, we went to hockey games. I don't know about hunting.
Hockey games. Okay, there we go. I'm paraphrasing. So things were going really well for how long?
I was best friends with Don from the time I arrived, which was fall of 2002, although I'd met him in the spring of 2002, up until spring of 2008, so 6 years.
6 years, absolutely.
Right, is that 6 years?
Let's enter a Mr. Feldon King Alexander to the mix. Now, I will go ahead and tell our audience, too, that I did go ahead and try and contact Feldon King Alexander. I left a voicemail, and I actually tagged him on Facebook on this very show. So he didn't get back to me in time. I just wanted to go ahead and give him the opportunity to go ahead and, send us his little two bits. But King Alexander had a little different way of taking education.
Yeah, King Alexander came in as president of the university in the last month of 2005. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, unlike our previous president, who was a terrific guy, this guy came in basically to pull the rug out from under higher education in California and put it in his own pocket, put the money in his own pocket. So, yeah, not a great guy.
Yeah. Well, he was a numbers guy. You know, he wanted to, you know, he came in with a great CV. He wanted to wow the people. And we'll get into this a little bit later. But basically on the back of a recommendation of, who was it, his godfather?
Yeah. King's, first of all, it's appalling to have to call someone King.
I know. Who names your child that? That child should be beaten
in school.
But
I guess we'll have to call him that because it'll take up less time.
There we go.
But when King's godfather was Charlie Reed, who's chancellor of the entire CSU system. The CSU system is the single biggest university system in the world. The godfather arranged various ways for King to come in. And you mentioned that he came in with a great CV. He actually came in with a CV that no one saw. It wasn't a great CV. It was a hidden secret CV. So that was a problem. In fact, we've only now just seen his CV now that he's leaving to go to LSU. LSU put his CV online to justify the fact that they hired him, even though the entire faculty there voted unanimously no confidence in the hire. So he's under siege there, and he hasn't even gotten there yet. And putting up his CV has only proven what a crook he is.
Yeah. Well, he starts actually at LSU in, I think, July of this year, 2013. So,
right.
He's going there. Actually, on his Wikipedia page, it actually states that LSU was not looking forward to his arrival. So I found that very interesting that he would actually include that on his own Wikipedia page.
Well, the great thing about Wikipedia is that everybody gets to fix it. That isn't what the initial press release was that got on there. There have been a number of us who have gone to his Wikipedia page and started correcting it.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, absolutely. enter two people, Lane and Pounds, who were very interesting.
Yeah, Dr. Michael Pounds is a lifetime academic who has been at Long Beach for 25 years, I think, and other universities prior to that. Incredibly astute, renowned scholar. Actually, one of his expertise are the social implications and racial implications of Star Trek. He's got books out on that. So we had a lot in common with Star Trek. And a colleague and my good friend. And, yes, he and I became the dissident duo at a point in early on when we started outing imposters with fake credentials and no one would listen to us, and we later found out why. And then we also outed some of the financial misstatements that were going on in 2009, I guess, because of the recession, they were doing all sorts of cutbacks and for teachers and the education side of the institution while they were pumping up the administration. And so we went public with proof of how they were lying to everybody. So, yes, my friend. And we sued the university at one point as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you had a little health scare in 2008, too, with kidney cancer. And you know, please say hi to your good, healthy kidney, and your four dogs and seven turtles. Absolutely.
I will. In case the dogs bark or the turtle, I don't know what noises the turtle will make, but if you hear barking.
If the turtle barks, then you got problems, Don.
Right. The voice of the turtle will be heard.
Absolutely. So, yeah, carcinoma of the kidney, and you thought it was due to stress.
I had been under siege because I had outed some imposters with fake credits, and the university kept saying to me, keep quiet, don't talk about this. I couldn't understand why they wouldn't just jump on it. You know, we had one guy who claimed he had a degree from Columbia University. It turned out he didn't have anything. He'd never even gone to Columbia University, and he didn't have that degree. He totally invented who he was and what he was, claimed he was a psychologist, and he wasn't. All his Hollywood credits were made up. I mean, it was ridiculous. And I got letters from the provost at the other universities confirming, like, we don't know this guy, he's lying. And I couldn't get King Alexander and Don Para to suspend or fire him. They wouldn't do anything. They told me I had to be quiet, you know, and not say anything. And if I said anything publicly, it would undermine any ability to get rid of him. And this went on for years. But then in 2008. It exploded publicly, and I was pretty ill all that year. thinking it was stress, and as you said, it turned out to be kidney cancer. So.
Yeah, now this is where I want to go to the vetting process and stuff.
Sure.
As an absolute idiot, I would just assume that I'm giving someone $25,000 of my hard-earned money to attend an academic institution worthy of being taught by people with the credentials that they would claim to have. How does that go unnoticed? How does that go unconfirmed?
This is a great question and the key question of it all, and Pounds and I have gone round and round over the years analyzing how this happens. I think the answer is because universities are well known to be, you know, you remember the old Henry Kissinger quotes about how petty universities are, because we all believe that within universities are professors fighting with each other jealously to try to each prove that one is better than the other, that there's this kind of ultimate daily vetting as who's better than who, right? So therefore, you would think it's a bastion of integrity, that maybe people with great credits are getting screwed over, but certainly no one with fake credits would move ahead because they'd be found out so fast. Well, it turns out that's not quite true. It turns out, but the belief in that leaves room for people with phony credits to step up and scam their way in. What you have instead are a lot of professors who are on search committees or review committees, and they're busy teaching and they're busy grading and they're busy trying to write their own material and do their own thing, and they really don't like to spend time on the committee stuff. And they're also told that they're not allowed to read somebody's CV and then really go outside and vet it. They're just supposed to look at what's put in the box that's handed them to show somebody's work. And so there's a little bit of laziness, of sloth, and there's also friendships. Somebody comes in and says, hey, my friend is up for the job here. Everybody assumes the friend is legit because you know that the guy who's recommending him is legit. So nobody – I've been on search committees. I'm responsible for – okaying the hiring of one of the guys who turned out to be an imposter and another person who turned out to be an imposter. I actually brought her in thinking she was legitimate. I had no idea she wasn't. She was, you know, so people vouch for people. And that's the problem in the information age. I had a student the other day who explained to me, he said, there's actually a course, secret course out there. I said, what are you talking about? He said, well, they teach you, if you pay them money, they teach you how to fake your credits on the web. And because of digital, and you would think digital would open the door to us finding out more truth, that you couldn't get away with lies because all I got to do is Google you and I could find it out. But the opposite is the truth. It turns out to be the case. It turns out that if you want to fake a credential, you put it there, you let it fester, you let it build, let it get some hits, you send it around, you put it in social media, and it becomes true by dint of repetition. And the next thing you know, you've created an entirely false identity.
Yeah, innocent until proven guilty, I guess, so to speak. You can't prove a negative. So, yeah, it disturbs me, and I think it disturbs our listeners as well to know that I would hate to go ahead and continue to believe that this is actually happening as a widespread problem across the United States and even Canada and Europe for that matter. I still do believe that integrity in truth is first and foremost, but apparently not the truth and not the possibility at CSULB. Now, moving ahead, I just want to go ahead and say, at the tail end of Chapter 1, you can go ahead and scroll down. Don, you are brilliant, but you're one of those scary people that keeps every friggin' email. And at the tail end of Installment 1, you can see all of the correspondence as to shut up, Brian, don't say anything to all of that stuff, letters from President Alexander to you directly, letters from you to President Alexander, and I love how you paraphrase by just saying F. King. Of course, there should be two asterisks in there, but I'm not going to go ahead and say that. Getting back to chapter 2 is the Spielberg documents. Now, Steven Spielberg, a definite well-known name in Hollywood, made a little bit of money on a few of his little small ventures and stuff like that.
I think he made a fish movie that did really well.
Yeah, something about, I don't know, a shark or shit, and there was a bunch of, you know, people walking and then a shower and stuff. I have no idea. But Steven returned to California State after, what, 20 years after being dropped out?
Dropped out in the late 60s, and he came back in 81-ish. In 2000. I keep saying 80. 2001 to graduate in 2002. He was graduating. Yeah, he got his degree, you know, decades later, the very year that I was coming in. I was coming in that fall, and he was graduating just before that.
Right. Now, your good buddy, Sharon Blumenthal, took personal responsibility for Spielberg's success in Graduation. She even got some flowers, I read.
She did.
If someone wanted to go ahead and collect $5, everybody have to put $5 in his friggin' mailbox, I read.
Yeah, I mean the key to Cal State Long Beach, unlike other universities, is you know, Jerry Brown is all over us these days about all of the universities in California about the graduation rates being low. He beat up the UCs the other day when their 4-year graduation rate was between 50% and 60%, 5-0 and 6-0. Our graduation rate was in those days forever, you know, 11%, 12% at the most in the 4 years. So people were not graduating in 4 years. And in 6 years, maybe half of them were graduating, which meant, you know, out of Spielberg's class, he was not the only dropout. More than a third of his class never graduated. So if you add that up year by year, you wind up with 10,000, 20,000, 30,000, 60,000, 90,000. You wind up with an insane number of students who started at the school, put in their years, but never finished up. So when Spielberg indicated that he wanted to come back and finish up, and he really had he didn't have a ton of stuff left to do. He had dropped out because he got the big deal at Universal and because he had a professor who was an alcoholic who had said he would never amount to anything and gave him a hard time. So Sharon Blumenthal took up the charge to help Spielberg get through the rest of his education, even though there was no way he could come to classes because he was on sets. So, my understanding in his mind was, hey, if they'll work it out so that I can get a degree, then other people who have not gotten their degrees but they have day jobs and they have families and they can't come back to classes, there ought to be a way to work it out for them too. So he was hoping to be the leader of. There were at least 60,000 people between the time he hadn't graduated and 2001, 60,000 people who hadn't graduated but should have, and now why not open the doors to allow them to come back and do their thing too, which, by the way, would have increased tuition, would have helped in a million different ways.
And restore a positive sense of self. I mean, you're going back, all the baby boomers trying to go ahead and finish what they started. I mean, everybody has regrets, and Spielberg is no different, I'm sure.
Absolutely. I mean, I've always found in Hollywood there were a number of people who were mega successes who didn't have degrees. And you would think, who cares? You guys are run the business. You know, Barry Diller is one of those. Merv Adelson was one. I mean, these are huge names, multi-billion-dollar names. And Spielberg, another one. And yet it sat on their shoulder like the biggest chip. Somehow they'd failed. Somehow they hadn't succeeded, somehow they were still do this, but, you know, it's amazing how it preys on some of them. Maybe it motivated them, perhaps, I don't know.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
I was going to add just another name to that, and you're going to laugh at me because this is not a member of the academic society, but Miss Tyra Banks with her return to Harvard and getting her business degree and stuff, and you're talking about a multi-million dollar, I would say, megalomaniac, and who was quite successful at it.
And I love it when the athletes who, you know, now that they can jump into the NBA early on and so they don't finish up, I love when they go back and do it and just, and say to the rest of us, look, college is important. We've screwed up. I mean, we're not off topic here at all in terms of college. Undergraduate education is not about getting a career. It is not a vocational school. You're not learning how to take transmissions apart so you can go get a job working in a transmission, transmission repair shop. You go to get an undergraduate education to learn how to think and to come away with a vast storehouse of knowledge in subject area. And you know, because we're all, none of us are kids anymore. You know that if anybody's listening out there who's a student, hear me well. Once you graduate college, or once you're done with college, however you finish it, you will not have the time to read and keep up with all the things that could interest you. You will be too busy with work and family and everything else.
Yeah.
Your one shot in those 4 years you're in college is that's your one big chance to really get into the expertise of all kinds of fields, even if they're not even remotely what you're going to make money on, but it may be something that makes you a better human being and a happier person. And
yeah.
Who knows, it may open the door to something else. So undergraduate education is tremendously important, and it's being misused and abused right now as being looked at as a vocational training instead, and I'm just sick of that.
Well, and also misperceived, too. In installment two, the Spielberg narrative, King Alexander, which, again, that makes me giggle inside, King Alexander kind of adopted sort of an Abercrombie Fitch mentality, saying that, you know, Spielberg's coming in, the cream of the crop, we want the valedictorians and stuff, and which really, I think, alienated a lot of students with the wherewithal to believe that I'm here to learn, not to come at it with learning. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think
so.
Absolutely true.
Go ahead. Yeah.
No, yeah, I mean, what the Spielberg connection was, in order to get into the film business, you need to be able to spend longer time in school and do a graduate program. And what I did, the reason I took the job at Cal State Long Beach was they specifically wanted me to begin to create a master's degree, an MFA program. And I thought that was just critical for these kids because it's an impacted major, which means you don't get into it until you're a junior. You can't teach film in 2 years. So basically we were graduating students who were not competent to go into the business. And if we had a graduate program, they could stay on and continue into the graduate program. SC has one, UCLA has one, I mean, all the good schools have them. We didn't. And so I went there to create that. I also knew that Spielberg would be interested in a program like that because it was a way of saying the film business is not just a technical, vocational business. It is a business of scholarship, of ideas, of writing and literacy. And so I knew he would embrace that, and that was where the money came from. Once we set up the MFA program, Spielberg immediately showed up with money to fund it because in its backhanded way, he could say, hey, you see, guys, I'm smart. I'm not just a guy with an eye for a camera angle. I'm a smart, literate guy. So that was our setup. But King Alexander had no love or respect for Spielberg at any point in time, that's for sure. Absolutely.
Well, I think he had love and respect for his title and for his money, because Spielberg actually graduated May 30th, 2002. It wasn't until 2006 that she actually got Dime One from Spielberg and was reading with it. Of course, your lovely friend Sharon Blumenthal was very, very anxious to turn around and try, along with Alexander, to get money from Spielberg as an endowment to go ahead and do something. I do agree with Spielberg's people saying that if we gave money too quickly, it would look like he just actually purchased his diploma, which the public is so fickle and so absolutely on point for stuff and for even thinking that. I would think that myself. But in 2006, and after multi reports back and forth with Spielberg's people, you actually ended up receiving, I think it was, what is it, $1.3 million over 3 years.
Yeah,
that's
just about 1.4, yeah. What it was was the MFA program began in 2006. The minute it started and it was real, Spielberg then signed his pledge and started sending his money. And the minute they pulled the plug on the program, he stopped.
Mm-hmm.
So sadly, that's what happened.
Well, I don't blame him. You know,
I don't blame him either.
Absolutely. Hey, you know, you're supposed to build a nice little building, and I don't see nothing happening. But actually, the organization, the foundation that you mentioned was actually in play for a good year. Spielberg's people came in and actually approved as of the work that Cal State LB was doing.
Yeah, they loved the program, the MFA program, and the students and the quality of the work we were doing. Most of the money had gone to the students who were involved in that program to subsidize them, and a chunk of the money out of the first batch went to upgrade one of our production facilities and some of our offices, and so they were pleased with all that. They were pleased enough that they thought things were going well, and they allowed his name to be put on the door. Up to that point, he was the anonymous donor, although everybody, you know, used his name anyway. So yes, they were quiet. They were approving, and they were indicating that we were going to get more money. It was all set to re-up it until, unfortunately, I had to get word to him that the program was dead, that they'd taken his last check under false pretenses and that they'd stolen some of the money outright for other purposes than his pledge agreement tied it to.
Yeah. Yeah, you have a personal, and I wouldn't say a personal relationship with Spielberg, but you've worked with family and friends, have gone out with his mother and everything like that. What's your connection to Spielberg?
You know, I have a long crisscrossing relationship with him involving the guy who first funded his first movie, Amblin, and then different people who have been his presidents of his company, and yeah, and you're right, family relations, and his, when I was in law school, his sister married a good friend of mine, and so we crisscrossed forever, and then finally his company put I had a book I was doing, and they put it into development as a miniseries, and so I actually finally, after all that time, got to meet him in a business environment in a couple of meetings over at Amblin. So
yeah,
we've crisscrossed in many ways.
And super charming. I've heard from many people.
You know, he's a force. He's a
yeah,
force.
An entity.
There are certain people that are like that. He just, you know, a different kind of charisma than like a Bill Clinton. He comes in and then, you know, he just, everything immediate. And it's not an ego thing. He's just going a mile a minute, and things are happening fast, and his head's into the details of everything all at once. And, you know, he's one of those people who walks in the room and everybody rises up a notch to operate better because he's operating at a higher level. So it's kind of that.
Yeah. Absolutely. George Lucas was also a contributor to donating $100,000, later on contributing a large amount of money to this, too. Any relationship to Lucas?
No. Lucas, our department chair, Craig Smith, who was also a trustee for the CSU, was able to use some personal connections with Lucas to get us $100,000 at a time when we were desperate to get equipment repaired. And Lucas very kindly helped us out. So no, but we didn't have any continuing tie there. And, you know, fortunately for USC, Lucas was willing to put in, you know, $100 million and get Spielberg to put millions in there as well. So SC got the bulk of the largesse, but we're not complaining about what we got. It's just too bad that Alexander blew it and we're not still getting it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And actually, Para and Alexander did throw away. I love your quote here about the Golden Goose. apparently, they wanted to go ahead, and there was a reinstallment that was going to be given by Spielberg, and through the dissolvement, through. You know, please explain to me the exact way that Alexander screwed this up for you, or for USC,
for CSULB, for Spielberg money.
Yeah. Yeah.
He did two things wrong. Number one, the Spielberg money was pledged and specifically allocated by Spielberg and his lawyers and all, you know, through negotiation, that it was supposed to go to these things. It was supposed to go to the students in the MFA program, and it was supposed to go to those upgrades and repairs, and it was very specifically defined where we go, and it was supposed to go to hiring some additional teachers for the programs. So number one, in the year of the quote-unquote recession, where the teachers were, you know, forced into taking a 10% pay cut, which they called a furlough, the school stole 10% of Spielberg's money that would have gone to a professor. Rather than, I mean, even if they had somehow justified saying, well, even though this particular professor is financed privately by Spielberg, everybody else is taking a 10% pay cut, so we'll take 10% pay cut and we'll pay him less, but we'll leave Spielberg's money in Spielberg's account. They didn't. They took Spielberg's money. So they stole 10%. Stole 10% of the money. In the end, the professor, you know, filed a grievance, and they had to pay him some of it back. He finally settled with them because it was just outrageous. But it was throwing it into Spielberg's face that he'd given this money and that he'd made a deal, and they were quite prepared to breach it without any consideration. And then secondarily, the money was supposed to go, as I said, to the MFA program, and they pulled the plug on the MFA program purely out of retaliation for whistleblowing.
Right.
And once they did that, it meant there was a big, fat, you know, $500,000 Spielberg check on the way that had nowhere to be spent because there was no more program to spend it on, and they took it and cashed it anyway.
Wow. And plus, too, you also pointed out, too, that the 10% furlough that was removed from salaries, if you were publicly funded, then that wasn't, you were not to be included in the furlough. Is that correct?
Well, if you were privately funded, you shouldn't have been included.
Privately funded, I'm sorry. That's what
I'm saying. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, if I give you If I donate $1,000 to the university and I say I want it to go to this particular student, you know, that's where I expect it to go.
Yeah.
You know, they can't have any excuse to say, well, we've decided, you know, we've redone our budget, so we're going to take half of it and only give the student $500. And that's basically what they did with the teacher. They just said, well, too bad, we're taking the money. And it was because the Alexander theory of running a university comes from his own father, who invented this idea. And the notion was, and there are some amazing quotes these people have given us, which will appall you. I mean, I know you saw them in the book, but they're really honestly true word for word. They believe that in a recession, the best way to improve education is by spending less money on education and more money on administration. As insane as that sounds, and as much as that sounds like we're in Alice in Wonderland, the head of finance at this university said to us in a press conference, don't you get it? When we go through these tough times with money, we need to hire more people to figure out how to spend less. And it was like how to catch 22. It was like Joseph Heller would have been proud of that line. It's like, what are you? And that is the King Alexander way of doing things. Then they argue that they should all get higher salaries because they have to work harder during a recession. Not only should there be more of them, but they have to work harder. And they all argue that they should be compensated the same as the head of Boeing or, you know, some outside or Google or Apple or whatever. They should be, you know, they should be paid like that, even though this is public money that they're being paid. You know, they should be competitive in the open market. And nobody says to them, hold on a minute, none of you administrators could ever get a job in the real world. What are you talking about giving you a competitive rate? A competitive rate for you would be zero. No one would hire you. You've hired yourself.
No, it absolutely sickens me too. Let's talk a little bit about the harassment that you received. How many times was your car searched? At one point, you were actually
the police out on me.
You're supposed to be carrying guns on campus and stuff like that. I read that.
Yeah, it's whenever I publish something in the paper, in the school paper or otherwise, that Alexander considers an affront to him, he calls the cops and files a false police report. This is the university police. Yeah. He files a false police report. And bear in mind, the university has 40,000 people there, so we have a legitimate real police force. These are not uni cops, as we used to call them in those schools. These are real police who are well-trained and good people. And I know, thank God, I know them well. And so yes, he will file false police reports just for the sake of harassment. So, yes, the officers showed up and at my office door, scared the hell out of my students, and apologizing to me for the fact that someone at the highest level at the university, as they said to me, had claimed I was bringing weapons to guns to campus. And so they needed to search me, my bags, my office, and my car. Even though, wink, wink, nod, nod, as they looked at me, they were, you know, they said, you know, we know you, and we're not really worried, but we have to do this. And then I was wearing a T-shirt and jeans, my normal clothing at the time. And the one officer said to the other, he goes, let's note for the record, because they didn't want to do the pat-down search thing. They said, let's note for the record that Professor Lane is wearing T-shirt and jeans, and if you were, you know, if he had a weapon, we would see it. And I said, you know, I'm offended that you haven't patted me down.
Something I would have enjoyed, but quite frankly, between you and I and the Great Blue Sky, that has got to rattle your nerves a little bit, because just the absolute gall to go that low for something that is true.
It's like a banana republic. The guy is running, you know, his own private banana republic with his own, and I don't mean the clothing store, with his own cops and his own information and his own newspapers, and getting away with quite literally murder. He's murdering people's careers right and left. That's for sure. You know, he couldn't pull that off with me, but I know other people that they've just done crazy stuff to, who've just literally gotten out of the business and just said, I can't take it, you know, and they can't afford lawyers. You know, luckily I am a lawyer and I can afford a lawyer. And so, and I keep a lot of information. You know, I'm an information hoarder, as my wife knows. And so I've kept every document. I've kept every email. I've got everything. And these people are so brazen, they don't realize it can come back to haunt them because they're just not used to having any oversight.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Number one, to anybody listening out there, don't send me an email because I will keep it.
This is why we're having
a conversation. It will be there.
Brian.
Yeah.
No, seriously, and I so appreciate that because, you know what, I'm the person that snoops For example, if I ever go to your house for dinner, I will snoop in your bathroom cabinets. I am that sick person. I warn everybody so everybody knows how to hide things and stuff like that. But that's what I really enjoyed about the whole SUG blog, is that the documentation is stupendous. I'm going to go now to installment three, Long Beach Studios, Don Pera and, of course, King Alexander. This was a lovely, lively chapter. They wanted to go ahead and purchase a Boeing soundstage to go ahead and have. Basically, the idea works for me. You know, you want to go ahead and have a mall and a hotel and stuff, so it's a one-stop filming facility. But that really falls by the way. So I love the way that you were invited to the presentation, too.
Yes. What happened is we were surprised early one year by getting invitations saying that it was an exclusive invitation just to selected professors in the school, in the university, not just the college, and that it was the big announcement that the university was somehow tied to the creation of what was going to be called the Long Beach Studios. Now, any of you out there listening, you can go to the web and look up the Long Beach Studios, and you will find their website. But they don't exist. The two con men made up this whole studio. And the essence of the studio was that they were going to buy the Boeing Corporation's huge manufacturing hangar. This was the hangar where they used to build 747s on an assembly line, basically, in Long Beach. And they were going to buy this huge hangar, and they were going to turn it into the world's biggest film studio. Now, the only problem with that is the hangar is at Long Beach Airport, which is a working jet airport. It's a hub for JetBlue. It's a commercial airport. You can't have a film studio at an airport unless you're doing silent movies. And even then, you get the vibrations. So the whole thing was just a joke. And yet the school was in on it, and Parra was part of it. He thought he was going to wind up on the board of directors of the thing, because these guys, these administrators, don't reveal that they get on all these boards. The minute King Alexander arrived in Long Beach to start his job, he wound up on the board of a bank and a medical company and another company, and they gave him shares and they paid him salary, and he made all this side money that he doesn't report, but we found out, and hasn't fully reported, but we know we found out enough of it. And so Parra had been one of those guys who, as dean, had not really known how to get into all that. But once he was tight with King, King was starting to show him the way. And so the Long Beach Studios was going to be a way for them to make money from both ends of the deal personally. And it turned out Alexander and his family had a long-time tie with Boeing. Mm-hmm. So they were definitely working the deal from both sides. They were helping these con guys who wanted to make the studio get tax advantages. They were helping them with the mayor. They were promising all of us at this presentation you talked about that every department on campus, that this was the greatest thing that had ever happened to this university, and every department on campus was going to be rewarded and earn a profit because of this. And the nursing school was the most excited because they kept jumping up and down going, oh, great, our nurses can train on the set. I never even understood what that meant because I've been on a million sets
really
in my life.
Yeah.
I've seen a nurse once. And I've been on sets where people died and there aren't people, there's not enough doctors and nurses to show up. And so it was all this crazy notion of what they were selling us were these Long Beach studios. And, of course, it never happened. There is no Long Beach studio, and there never will be a Long Beach studio. And somehow Alexander and Parra were going to make money, and maybe even did make some money off of it. They haven't disclosed. They've never even admitted
they
had lunch with these people.
I think you put down, too, the sale of the actual facility that we're talking about was $500 million. Is that correct?
I think that's right. We can double check. It ultimately sold to a company out of Irvine. They bought the hangar and a lot of the acreage around it.
Right.
So, I can't remember what the deal was. It was a very big deal. But they're building offices.
Let's talk about Jay Samet, the CEO of Long Beach. I found that fantastic. He's the president of Sony's New Media Connect, who was briefly trying to outdo iTunes, which I found that to be such a – Sony Connect was an industry joke, quite frankly. And the reason I know this is that I pride myself on knowing people like you who know people in the industry that, if it looks like shit and smells like shit, it's really a pile of shit. I'm so sorry. I don't know how – let me ask you this from your point of view. And I mean no disrespect to Don Parra at all whatsoever, but
oh, go ahead, disrespect
him. I don't want to say that because he's not here, but is King Alexander really that brilliant to be the puppeteer on so many levels and still become relatively unscathed besides speculation? I mean, is he really that person?
You know, it doesn't take brilliance, it takes brazenness.
That I'll give you. Absolutely.
Okay, I mean, it's kind of that. We, you know, as writers and people who watch entertainment, we tend to think that every criminal is you know, brilliant and has figured it all out and is a chess player and, you know, has done this and that. And the truth is, if you're, you know, a lawyer and you've dealt with any of this stuff, it's you're just dealing with people who are opportunistic and bold.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and nobody catches them. I guess the good news on that score is that philosophically, emotionally, most of us believe people are good, and therefore we're suckers. You know, until it's proven to us that someone has cheated us, we don't grasp that. So the answer to your question is King Alexander and his family have made a career out of getting away with corruption, things that and acts that I consider to be utterly criminal. And they haven't been caught yet, and now they're getting caught. So we'll see what happens, you know.
Absolutely.
And they're aggressive. You're usually aggressive about suing anybody who says anything negative about them. So
well
see.
But I think too, you know, the best opposition is a good – what the hell is that saying? The best defense is a good
best
offense.
Best offense
kind
is a good
thing.
Defense, and best defense
absolutely,
is a good offense.
Absolutely, which is a pile of crap. Now, you make mention, and I actually emailed Donna at I think it was 2:30 in the morning at this point, stating that my favorite line written so far was, shaking O'Halloran's hand is like being forced to fist the rectum of a shaved pink piglet. It's hot and humid, and your fingers can't unravel. And when you look down, all you see is your wrist ending abruptly at this loaf of shapeless bubblegum flesh. The visual is disturbing, Brian. I'll have to go ahead and tell you that.
Yeah, I worked long and hard on that line. It's tough to come up with a good fisting line.
Well, especially when it's meant in the intent that it was written, it's just quite brilliant. Long story short, at the end of Chapter 3, Long Beach Studios was no more. At this point, Brian, how many people have you actually blown the whistle on? We have Para, Charles Reed, Berlin, King Alexander, your lovely friend,
you know,
Sharon Blumenthal.
It's hard to know how to do the scorecard by individuals as opposed to by actions. I mean, because I never started off thinking the term whistleblower, even dissident, had never occurred to me. I'm just one of those horrible people who's self-righteous and totally focused on truth, and you know, always willing and ready to let the chips fall where they may, and happy to own up to my own failings. And so, if I see a situation that I know that I believe is wrong, you know, I want something done about it, and I get to be, you know, when it was dealing with students, and I really felt my students work so hard to get through school and to earn the money to get through school that it was just absolutely appalling that they be, you know, shorted in any possible way. And so I had the mother cub thing too. So when I blew the whistle, it was on situations. It was, yes, there was the one person, then there was the second person who were imposters. Then there was the other person who I felt was taking advantage and berating and treating students poorly. So, you know, at least a dozen individuals who I felt should not be there, you know, in and around students, that they were either cheating the system and stealing money or they were abusive to students. I mean, we had a teacher at one point, I haven't written about him yet, but we had a teacher who literally had an anger management problem and was abusive to students.
Man.
And there'd be all these reports, and nobody did anything about it. What finally, you know, I finally just said, I've had enough. And I actually became a lawyer for one of the students who wanted to report him. And I went in to Para and everybody else and said, I'm this guy's lawyer. I'm not going to tolerate my client being treated this way. And that led to the discovery of a videotape of the teacher being abusive, just like you see in Rutgers and some of these other things. People have the evidence. They're just too afraid to do anything with it. Or they, you know, as you saw with Penn State and whatnot, they don't know what to do with it. They don't know what to do. Yeah. Then they're going to cover their own asses. And so it's my long-winded way of saying I think I probably blew the whistle on somebody every year. I've been there 12 years.
Well, and true, whistleblower really is French for hero. So, quite frankly, well, you know what? There are so many injustices right now, and with all the people keeping quiet, I mean, a great saying that a good friend of mine always uses is, "I saw something that needed to be done, and I realized that could be me." And I think a lot of us go ahead and tend to take the other route, turn the other way. And I mean, you've watched What Would You Do with John Quinones and stuff, and everyone
who get
active and who don't and stuff. So, on behalf of all the times you haven't heard it, I think you're a hero. We're going to go ahead and take a break, go to a little bit of music. This is Michael Albin. The song is called Hero. When we get back, we're going to delve into a little bit more of King Alexander's business practices. Don't go away. More with Brian Allen Lane when we get back.
It makes me sick. It's criminal that you can do all the things you've done.
Talking to Brian Allen Lane, one of my new heroes. Brian, we're going to chapter installment 4, High Crimes and Misdemeanors, where we get to be introduced to the Oxford Roundtable, a very interesting installment.
Indeed. And thank you for the hero thing, but you know what? I want to say to everybody out there, This isn't about heroism. This is life is about doing the right thing, and you live in a society, and you have obligations to do the right thing for each other.
Absolutely.
I mean, whether it's rescuing that loose dog you see in the street, whether it's, as you did at the beginning of the show, sending $10 to help out the folks in Oklahoma. I love that you just said, hey, you got the $10, send it. You know, I know you got it, and they need it.
You're sitting
know,
at a bar
exactly.
right now listening to this. Absolutely.
Yeah, we all, I mean, you know, come on, guys. Everybody needs to stand up when they see something wrong. You know, I mean, you have to do it, and you have to have opinions about it, and that's another great reason for thinking about the importance of college and philosophy and understanding who you are and what you are and what your place in the universe is, for gosh sakes. Anyway, so thank you for the compliment, but I don't feel heroic. I just,
don't worry.
I'm a guy who, if I can't look myself in the mirror, I know I did. You know, I know I haven't done something I needed to do, and so I always make sure I can look myself in the mirror. It's that simple.
Yeah.
As to the Oxford Round Table, oh my gosh, what would you like to know? The Alexander family, I think, is, I'm going to pitch them to Showtime as a spinoff of Shameless, because I think it should be a new series. The Alexander family.
I wonder if you know a writer or something.
Exactly. starting with their father, Kern Alexander. All these guys have names that are, you know, the same, but they go by their middle name. So Samuel Kern Alexander Jr. is King Alexander's father. And there's a Samuel Kern Alexander III is King's brother. And there's a Wesley Kane, and there's a somebody Clint. And so you go by the middle name. So it's Kern, and it's Clint, and it's King, and it's Kane. And then I don't know what they call the third. I just call him Kern the Third. so this thing, you know, they've run out of, you know, creating a sense of royalty that they don't really have. Over the years, they have come up with lots of interesting ways to fund themselves. And my contention is that none of these ways are legal. But they keep moving fast enough that you can't quite catch them. But now maybe we can. And that's some, I'm beginning to give you some material that has not been published yet, but is going to be. And one of their entities is a thing called the Oxford Round Table, which they created as a as an educational seminar of high repute, high profile and high repute, which takes place at Oxford. And as it turned out, had nothing to do with Oxford. They just rented the space. And so they got a lot of money from people to go there, and even more money from people to have their works published by the Alexanders. And on top of that, they got sponsorship money from a lot of corporations, and the money is not accounted for. It's really pretty simple. I mean, internally it is, because I know where it went, they know where it went, and they know who pocketed it. But externally, it doesn't add up, what's going on over the years. And in order to make this thing work, they've had more than two dozen different corporations owned just by them, by the family, because they just keep setting them up so that they can collect money and then not paying their taxes, not filing their tax returns, quickly moving on to a new corporation. I've really never seen anything like it. You know, honestly, I hope the government looks at it
well,
and decides I think it falls under RICO, to be honest with you. So.
Well, absolutely. The disturbing thing is, if you go to Chapter 4, too, and scroll down a little bit, you'll see that the Oxford Roundtable in the United States is at 6216 East Pacific Coast Highway, Suite 230, which is a mini mall and a post office box. And there is a number. And you know what? I couldn't go ahead and get the absolute MP3 to work. So this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to go ahead. You may have a little bit of feedback here, but if you go ahead and stay quiet, if you go ahead and phone this number, the number is 866. Let me just double check this here. 866 ORT. I love how they do the British ORT 3411. If you actually call this number, this is what you get. Don't go away. I'm just going to try and do this real old school. So I'm still there. Don't go away. This is what you get to hear.
Hello, you've reached Jeanette at the Oxford Roundtable. Please leave a message after the beep. Thank you. At the tone, please record your message. When you have finished, you may hang up or press 1 to change your message.
Now, Jeanette is...
Uh-huh.
Go ahead.
Jeanette is King Alexander's wife.
Who was his assistant.
He was the father's assistant for many years.
Right.
The girlfriend of King's brother, Clint, then King's girlfriend, while he was married to someone else and she was married to someone else. And you know, a real John Edwards story here.
Yeah.
Of his wife, his first wife dying from breast cancer, but even before that was going on, he was hardly a faithful chap. And lo and behold, he wound up marrying Shanat eventually when he came to Long Beach, and she is the official coordinator and was the treasurer of the Oxford Round Table. And as you point out, they claim they have big suites and offices. They have nothing. They have a post office box in Long Beach. They have Kern's home address in Illinois now as their other office, which isn't an office. In England, they have no office. They just have a mail drop. As you saw, I wrote to the people in England. They said, oh, no, it's just a mail drop. And here's a little exclusive for you. Guess where the family has another post office address that might be relevant to anybody who wants to investigate them?
Oh, please tell me.
Zurich, Switzerland.
No.
One would presume there might be some bank accounts there full of money.
Well, you know what actually I found with the answering machine stuff like that is that if you phone any academic institution, if you want this, press 1. If you know the party's extension, press 3-digit extension. I mean, there's a menu which I find is just so funny that they would go so old school with that. So,
well, they're operating,
you know,
they operate out of their house. They operate out of their house. It's completely designed to find a way to relieve people of money for credentials that aren't real. You know, so it's a way for people to think they've attended a great event that they haven't, to pretend they've been published when they haven't. I mean, King Alexander takes publication credit for his own publication that he edits that people pay to be in, and he acts like it's his book. This is, you know, LSU, great. It really knows how to read a CV because it's right there on his CV.
Yeah.
So
speaking about a CV, which that comes up in chapter 6 and chapter 5, if you go ahead and scroll down a little bit, you'll get to go ahead. I love how everything has a $15 filing fee for all the corporations and everything, and then King is always the treasurer.
He's varied depending on the company. Literally, at this point, I've found over 30 companies, so it depends on which company. Sometimes he's secretary, sometimes he's treasurer, sometimes he's vice president. It can all be all over the place.
Oh, yeah.
But in the particular one you're looking at, I think he was treasurer of that one. I think you're right.
Yeah. It gets worse and worse and worse. Chapter 6, which is my fantastic favorite, is when you actually go ahead and, you know, I'll be honest with you, Brian. At this point, it was like 4:30 in the morning, and as I'm reading his CV, I'm thinking, like, no wonder no one went ahead and checked any of this information, because it is so vast and so incredibly vague. There are actually no page numbers. There's no footnotes. There's nothing that you would actually, you know, look for.
If you any of the citations he has in his CV, every student knows, if you put that kind of a citation or annotation into a term paper, you get flunked. It does not follow any, that's what you're saying, it does not follow any cognizable form where you can check on stuff. What fascinated me, and I talked to FBI profilers about this years ago, when we were first finding the imposters back in, you know, several years ago, right, the guys who had the fake CVs at our school that Alexander didn't want to do anything about, it was really hard because in a single sentence they would tell four lies, and they were all bootstrapped on each other. And so it was hard, as you said earlier, it's hard to prove that something didn't happen, but it's not that hard. But what I found was they had a commonality to what they did. They would change dates just a little bit. They would phrase things a little bit odd. It gave them wiggle room. And so I talked to profilers about this, and I talked to a bunch of reporters who are academic reporters who are into this stuff, and he said it fits the same pattern every time. When people are lying about their stuff, they do it in a way that makes it hard for you to check. And then when you do find it out or say, wait a minute, you didn't get it, that didn't happen that year, they just go, oh, well, so it's off by a year, and act like that's no big deal, that it didn't need, you know, it's not brain surgery, it didn't need to be that precise. Or they blame a typist or a secretary or someone else who, you know, let that happen. I remember there was a famous case not very long ago where Notre Dame hired a new football coach, and before he could actually take the job, they fired him because they found out he had claimed a master's degree he didn't have. And his answer for that was, oh, well, at my last job, the publicity person put it on my bio, and I just never corrected it. Right? It's like today, I was thinking today when you were doing my credits at the beginning of the show and you were saying some stuff, and no offense, but some of it was misstated. It made me sound great. Like, you made me sound like I produced the pilot for Remington Steel, which I did not. I worked on the show in the second year, but I wasn't there for the pilot. But think of how quickly that gets picked up. And then if I want to live with it, I could be the pilot producer for Remington, who's going to be, you know, unfortunately, the man who was one of the producers is, you know, is in ill health at the moment. Once he's gone, who's going to ever correct it, you know?
Well, the funny thing is, buddy, that what I did was actually read directly from your CSULB page, and that's the way it's written. So it is different, and point in point, that perhaps something with a misplaced, you know, comma, you know, a semicolon stuff gets misconstrued. And I guess the point is, how picky are we as a public to pick up on this and to question it or just take it for face value?
Not only is the public, apparently we're not at the college level either, even when that's your job, is to be vetting. I've said to the school forever, the NCAA hires lawyers to do vetting now. That's what we should be doing. In any of these situations of tenure, promotion, job hiring at the administrative level or the teaching level, people should be vetted by lawyers who are picky about it and will dig into it and know when they're being lied to, or even when it's just an exaggeration. And sometimes it's an exaggeration. Sometimes it is a mushing of things where it isn't a complete invention like a degree you didn't have, but you're like, okay, I think I know what you may be talking about. My thing is, you know, my resume is 12 pages long. To combine that down to a biography, one says he wrote and or produced, you know, all these scripts and all these, or worked for all these shows, not meant to imply at all specifically that I did any one thing on any one particular. But if you go to my resume, it specifically says he wrote this, or he produced this, or he did that, or he wrote this and it didn't get produced, but he got paid anyway. You know, it's like it's detailed. So I can see how that happens that way. But these guys intentionally leave names off, add names in. King Alexander on his CV, this is the classic to me. This is all I needed to see. First of all, he lied about the budget of what the that he oversees at our campus.
Right.
He inflated it by $170 million in order to help.
Well, that's easy to look up.
Well, that's it. Why would you lie about someone that's so easy to check? I mean, especially in this day and age, I get in 2005, but in 2013, everything is so cross-referenced, and you can find out anything.
It's not, because then he says that, and then that becomes the new number that gets, because then LSU puts that out, and now when you check, now when you Google King Alexander, what comes up is the LSU stuff. And so now suddenly the budget of California State University Long Beach has gone up by $170 million, according to LSU.
Wow.
And that becomes the new truth. And, you know, when he talks about graduation rates, when he talks about how much money he's raised for the school, all made-up numbers that have changed dramatically. If you take the time to Google and read every document, you go, wait a minute, there's three different numbers all in the same month. What's going on here? And they vary by $20 million or $50 million or $80 million. Something's off. But if you don't dig, you're just going to read the first few search results, and they're going to be consistent because these guys push to make sure that those are the ones that come up. I looked at something last night for Alexander, and it had the new numbers. And it's just like, oh, my God, the new truth has already taken hold because people are Googling his current LSU stuff since he's in the news, and that's now going to be the new truth. And the current LSU stuff has to do with what he did at Long Beach, and it's all just a pack of lies. He says he has on his CV that he did three books. He's never done any book, ever. But he's got three books, and people are now crediting him for writing three books. Never done anything. The longest paper he's ever written was, you know, 10 pages other than his dissertation.
Yeah.
So, you know, I laugh
because it's so sad. It's so sad where things have gotten. But, you know, once again, I do have to applaud you for standing up and, you know, basically exposing the mistruths for what they are, because, like I said, you know, with all the information out there, we're a gullible public, and we believe what's written, and we believe what's told to us, and it's always good to question.
And again, isn't that the point of what we should be teaching our students in college? Isn't that the point of an undergraduate education, to teach you to question? And that's what's failing
exactly.
to turn it into vocational school. You know, teach Absolutely. You to not, and it doesn't mean doubt. It doesn't mean not believe. It means understand what's really being said. Understand the truth. Make sure you own what you're about to repeat to someone. So,
as an individual, I'm sorry, do your due diligence. You know, do your digging around. Find out if what's being told to you is truthful and honest. And, you know, that's up to us. I mean, no one else can teach us that.
King Alexander is being handed a 4-year contract for $651,000 a year, and I'm sure there's built-in bonuses, and we know he's going to have other board memberships and other things and other income on top of that. You're talking about millions of dollars being handed him in a state that's broke, Louisiana.
Yeah.
You would think they would look and prove that he really is the guy they're giving the money to.
Oh, absolutely.
It really is appalling.
I don't mean to be this person, but I don't know, and please, I mean, no disrespect, but I don't know how a dean of a university can get paid more than the president of the United States of this country.
Exactly. They've come up with this fake market value thing that the president, you know, that what they do is they back into these numbers. This is a perfect King and Kern Alexander argument structure. They look at the value of the business, and they say, okay, it's you know, $3 or $4 billion business. The head of other $3 or $4 billion, you know, Fortune 500 companies make this amount of money.
Mm-hmm.
But that's different. That's a private company where they have to answer to tax with their shareholders. This is a public institution. Once this guy gets his money, we don't get to fire him. We don't get to stand up and go, hey, we don't like the return. There's no return on investment here. We're just graduating kids.
Yeah.
It's insane.
Wow.
But they've pulled this off by pretending that public education is a private, profitable company when it's a non-profit public company.
Yeah.
So it's a madness. I would say the gratifying thing about this discussion and the publication and all that have been the number of people who have come to me who are insiders who have worked with the Alexanders and worked with Parr and worked with other people over the years, or even their own family members, who have said, you've now given me someone I can tell the truth to. I've known stuff, and I've not known who to go to or how to beat these people or how to get the truth out, but clearly people are reading your truth, so let me tell you stuff. So I am getting information that is making my hair fall out. Let me put it to you.
Wow.
Yeah.
How many more installments do you think you actually have?
The original plan was just to do 2 more and then do a full-blown, real, you know, All the President's Men kind of book, which would really have everything. Because it's become a kind of living novel where people are sending me information and people are, you know, commenting and I'm commenting back, and things are in the news because of these guys, it's that part of it has taken on a life of its own. So I suspect it's going to split. I suspect that what will happen is that the online part will be more of the updated news, which I can do fairly quickly. It's hard writing the other stuff, but just kind of give the updates on the news of what we've discovered or not discovered, and then the book installments, which have the more personal stories in them, can come later. And so I think that's probably what's going to happen, because people are really hungry for more stuff every week, and it's just not possible to turn it around that fast. Plus,
no,
I vet my sources. I want double sources. I treat this as a journalist. I want to know that what I'm saying is true. So, you know, that takes time.
Absolutely. Wow. Brian Allen Lane. Check him out at www.thugthebook.blogspot.com. Brian, we're running out of time. I want to thank everybody up in chat. Donna, thank you so much for being so anal retentive with the tweaking of the show promo last night. I tell you, you got a good woman by your side. Many thanks to Goofy Bone, guest 3922, guest 4386, guest 4558, guest 5594, guest 6233, and my brother from another mother, Mr. Mike Collip. Thanks to Shannon for producing chat room tonight. David, or Brian, I'm sorry. Jesus, why do I always go to David now? I am
David
so thrilled.
David and Goliath.
So, That's exactly what I have written down here, David fights Goliath, which I applaud you for fighting the good fight. Brian, it has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for coming to At Home with Victoria with this. It was a brilliant read. I look forward to reading more. I can't thank you enough for opening my eyes to something I should have been open to a while back. It's challenging, and I applaud you for putting up with the searches, the questioning, the ridicule, the everything you're about to go ahead and deal with. This book cannot be easy to formulate, but buddy, you're doing a great job, and I can't thank you enough.
Hey, thanks much. Thanks for having us on. Glad we got to give you the exclusive and a hint of what's coming. And you know, we've got 50,000 readers already. I imagine that's going to skyrocket.
Yeah, proud of you. That's pretty impressive. Absolutely.
Thanks, Donna.
Brian, love you tons. Love to Donnie. I'm going to give you a call back in about 5 minutes, okay? As soon as I close
okay,
the show.
Thanks
Huge
so
thanks,
much.
Everybody. Take care.
Take care.
That was Brian Allen Lane. Fantastic chat, and once again, an exclusive in finding out exactly what's happening with education today. Once again, go ahead and check them out at thugthebook.blogspot.com. All the chapters are 6 actually up and running, and once again, he includes every piece of documentation, every piece of correspondence, and well worth a fantastic read. Thanks to all up in chat once again. Going to close with a little bit of music from Matt Zardy. Very appropriate. Change begins with you. Thanks again for listening to At Home with Victoria. I'm Michael Kay, your entertainment co-host. We're back next week.
Yeah.
with Victoria, an interactive news and entertainment show on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Download us on iTunes as a free podcast and like us on Facebook. I'm Shelly Rand, musician and announcer for At Home with Victoria. Download my CD on iTunes and Amazon and friend me on Facebook.